All right, our second case this morning is number 21-12540, Louis Clements versus the state of Florida. Mr. Upson, we know that you were also appointed by the court to represent Mr. Clements, and like with Ms. Howard, we want to thank you for your service to us and to Mr. Clements.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Keith Upson for Louis Clements. Good morning. Thank you for permitting argument in this matter, and thank you for setting this by Zoom, which turned out to be somewhat serendipitous because I am presently COVID positive. So I would not have been allowed in the courtroom this week regardless. The trial court's order found Florida Statute 943-0435, which is likely the last time I will say it in its entirety, and we'll refer to it simply as the registration statute or the statute. The district court found it was neither a sentence nor punishment by somewhat simplistically relying on 36 words contained in paragraph 12 that are contradicted by many of the remaining 6,061 words of the statute itself. The court essentially found that because it says it isn't punishment, it isn't, therefore Mr. Clements isn't in custody and therefore no jurisdiction under 2254. I'd like to quickly go through three sections of the statute, starting with paragraphs 7 and 8. Paragraphs 7 and 8 are particularly interesting because they impose on registrants in person before the fact requirements regarding interstate and international travel, requiring 48 hours to 21 days notice, depending on the length of travel. Outside of the state of Florida. Paragraph 8.
Can I ask you just a quick question about that one? Because, I mean, at least in my own mind, I'm sort of focused on the movement restrictions in the statute. So, I mean, those aren't prohibitions or restrictions, really, just notice requirements?
We would argue they are restrictions, Your Honor, even though it doesn't say prohibited. And I appreciate the distinction. And the reason is because if Florida passed a statute with similar reporting requirements to law enforcement for all citizens, I think we'd all agree that that would impermissibly impinge on the fundamental right to interstate travel. I don't think that would pass constitutional muster. What's different about the registration statute is the Florida legislature said that it's okay to do that to designees. The difference and the reason why it matters is it's no less a restriction. It would be a restriction if it were imposed on non-registrant private citizens. Therefore, constitutionally, it would be. Therefore, it is a restriction on that fundamental right, notwithstanding the fact it says you can't leave. Or doesn't provide that you can't travel out of the state.
So then I guess this sort of gets to one just sort of fundamental concern I had about the kind of the squishiness of the Jones test. Do you mean to say that any restriction on movement, however slight, that would not apply to a private citizen renders one under this statute in custody?
It's sufficient that it takes the statute beyond simple status, that we're no longer talking about, oh, this isn't punishment or punitive. This is just your status, and makes that consequence punitive.
But if to take Judge Newsom's question a step further and put some practical gloss on it, if the only residency restriction in a statute like this one said, you cannot live within 100 yards of an elementary school, but that's it, that's the only restriction, would you contend that that renders the person subject to that restriction in custody?
It would certainly be a tougher argument, Your Honor.
So my concern was also, or my focus was also on the residency restriction, but And there's been a lot of coverage, or at least there had been a lot of coverage in Florida about the way that these residency restrictions worked and the way that they limited the ability of restricted the ability of convicted sex offenders to live in certain places. There was a famous CNN story some years ago about such individuals in Miami having to live under the Rickenbacker Causeway because there was nowhere else in the city of Miami where they could live pursuant to residency restriction. But here's my question. If we're looking at the residency restrictions as a part of the in-custody analysis, are we looking only at the residency restrictions imposed by state law? Because that's the law that requires registration and imposes residency restrictions? Or are in your mind, are we also looking at local residency restrictions that are passed pursuant to authority given by the registration statute?
Well, Your Honor, on further consideration of your initial, I'd like to revise my answer to your question about residency restriction and unambiguously say, yes, I do think that the restrictions themselves would constitute in custody. And I think this court would have to look at both because we're not challenging the constitutionality of the restrictions. We're simply arguing that the consequences are such to constitute punishment or punitive measures against registrants sufficient to argue that they're in custody.
Go ahead, Judge Newsom.
Well, so I was just going to follow up. So to Judge Jordan's initial question, if the lone restriction was you can't live within 1,000 yards of a school, no others, not churches, not playgrounds, anything else, so that's the lone restriction. And you can live anywhere else you want to. You can go anywhere else you want to without notifying anybody. That alone renders you in custody? Sort of your revised answer, I think, is yes.
Well, I understood it to be a rhetorical question because clearly there aren't facts. I can envision a situation in which a registrant would effectively be rendered homeless by being unable to comply with the residency restriction, in which case that's tantamount to being in custody.
Got it. So your response to Judge Jordan is not in response to his simplified hypothetical, if the only restriction is you can't live within 1,000 yards of a school, full stop. It's that if you're effectively rendered homeless, then you're in custody. By overlapping, these bubbles, imagine them, these circles of where you can't live. If you're effectively rendered homeless by the combination of those circles, then you're in custody.
Well, and Your Honor, I think part of what I'm more thrown by is the overlap between constitutionality and the in custody requirements, because such restrictions have consistently been held to be constitutional.
I think neither Judge Newsom nor I are, for purposes of our questions, trying to call any of those restrictions into any doubt. We're taking them as given. But it seems to me that if your homeless theory is a workable one, and I'm not sure that it is, but if it's a workable one, doesn't it also take into account local residency restrictions? And local municipalities, cities, towns, et cetera, aren't the ones that impose the registration requirements, right? They come from their own police power.
That's so correct.
How do you link those local residency restrictions with the registration requirements of a state statute?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the impact on the registrant. And not,
I don't disagree with you in general terms, but then if it's the local residency restrictions that render a person like Mr. Clements homeless, whose custody is he in?
Well, the local municipalities only act under the authority of the state. So it
right,
it
all, but they don't have to.
But it all rolls back uphill to the state.
I know they've all enacted laws. We all understand that. But whose custody is Mr. Clements in if he's rendered homeless, not because of state residency restrictions, which are minimal in my hypothetical, but because of local residency restrictions, which are much more broad?
It's still the state.
Okay. Now, none of those issues were really fleshed out below. And believe me, I understand that Mr. Clements was proceeding pro se and that you weren't representing him there. But there was nothing in the complaint or in the response to the motion to dismiss to flesh out this sort of theory of displacement by homelessness and all of that equaling or being tantamount to custody, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But the court's decision was an interpretation of the law, which, of course, this court can review de novo. And Mr. Clements candidly has two hurdles. One is the express provision of that paragraph 12 that says this is not the thing that the remainder of it says it is.
Can I change gears for a moment, if you don't mind, just before your time runs, because I want to also ask your friend on the other side the same question. As you know, the statute says in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court. And, you know, in the case law, it's been sort of described as having two requirements, one in custody and two pursuant to this judgment of a state court. And what I'm wondering is, in this case, I hope you start feeling better. I'm sorry to see you're sick. But getting back for a moment to the case, in this case, we have for the pursuant to the judgment of a state court, it's not in the actual judgment itself. And also, we have said in another case, Houston v. Williams, that the Florida sex offender statute is not punitive. So it seems like we're probably bound by that conclusion. So I'm wondering, you know, like on that part of the equation, it seems like you might have a problem. How does that mesh with the in custody requirement? In other words, if you have a problem on the pursuant to the judgment of a state court requirement, can you still overcome it on just the in custody requirement alone?
With the what I perceive to be the easier resolvable of the two, and of course the record that's before the court is the record, but it was my understanding that the Mr. Clements' requirement to register pursuant to the statute is contained within the verbiage of the judgment sentence itself. By reference, it doesn't enumerate all the requirements, but if that answers that facet of that question, Judge Rosenbaum, and I apologize, I don't think I completely followed the other hurdle about the in custody component.
Well, just because we're running over time, I'll just go to that part of it, which is that in Houston v. Williams, we described, it was an ex post facto case. It wasn't this kind of case, but still it involves the same analysis as far as whether the statute is punitive or not. And we held that it was not punitive. And so I wonder how that affects your analysis on the rest of the test.
Actually, Your Honor, if I may, I'd like an opportunity to supplementally brief that to the court with a fairly short window of 7 to 10 days, if I could, or if the court would consider it. It was our position that those 36 words contained in subparagraph 12 should be disregarded by the court. Under the absurdity doctrine, because the weight of the remaining 6,000 words of the statute, in fact, do impose restrictions on registrants that impinge on at least two fundamental rights. The privacy right, we were far less concerned with, but the right to interstate travel to an extent that it's not simple registration anymore, but rises to the level of placing Mr. Clements in custody for the purposes of being able to avail himself of 2250, of having jurisdiction under 2254.
Can I ask just one final question, Judge Jordan?
And yes, go right ahead.
What I don't want you to do is to reveal any client confidences or privileged material. I am curious about the decision not to brief the case, to leave us with Mr. Clements' pro se brief before us. Frankly, there's a lot of uncertainty in this area of the law. It sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty on the panel about how all of this fits together. And I'm just wondering, did you consider filing a counsel brief on Mr. Clements' behalf?
I did, Your Honor. And strategically, I wish we were in Pennsylvania or the third, but we're not. And I felt argument, I'm not quite sure how to answer here. I could have, and I believe I may have put this in the notice of adoption or standing on the brief. I can write a different brief. I don't know that I can raise the core issues available any better than Mr. Clements already did.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, Ms. Frumpton, thank you very much. You've saved your time for rebuttal. Ms. Ashby.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Katie Ashby on behalf of the Secretary of Florida Department of Corrections. As Judge Rosenbaum pointed out, the jurisdictional requirement has two components. First, that the petitioner is in custody, that is, that there's a significant restraint on his physical liberties not shared by the public generally. And the second is that such custody must arise pursuant to the state court judgment. Stated differently, that the custody that is conditioned precedent to habeas jurisdiction has to be a direct result of the conviction or the sentence under attack.
Ms. Ashby, if I could, let me try to ask you some hypotheticals and see where you think you land on them. So let's assume that a person like Mr. Clements was convicted in Florida, okay, of a sex offense that makes him subject to the registration requirements under Florida law. And so the registration requirements are a consequence of a Florida criminal judgment, okay? Also assume for me that the residency restriction portion of the registration statute allows a person like Mr. Clements to only live in 5% of the land covered in Florida. Is he in custody?
So just to clarify, so you said in this hypothetical, he only has access to 5% of the land. And then you said that the judgment.
He's convicted in Florida of a sex offense, which makes him subject to registration and residency requirements and restrictions under Florida law. Okay.
Right.
So he has to register under Florida law, but I'm changing the residency portion of the statute a little bit for you in a hypothetical. And so in my hypothetical, he can only live, putting aside the registration and notice issues, he can only live on 5% of Florida land. Is he in custody?
Well, whether or not he would be in custody, that still wouldn't change the part that has to be pursuant to the court judgment. So
the court judgment makes him subject to the registration and residency statute. That's one of that's a requirement of supervised release or supervision under the court judgment. You shall be subject to the registration and residency requirements set forth in Florida statute blank, blank, blank. And the person has a supervised release term of life. So the registration is going to be for life. And he can only live in 5% of Florida land. Is that a different case? Is he in custody?
Potentially, Your Honor, but I mean, that's not the case before.
No, I completely understand that it's not this case, but the same way that I asked Mr. Upton about a restriction only limiting a person to living within a certain number of distance from an elementary school, I want to ask you the opposite hypothetical, which is harder for your side, I think. So you think residency restrictions, at least theoretically, are relevant. Is that an accurate statement of your view?
Yes, I think they're relevant to the analysis, absolutely. Okay. But in this case, too, there's nothing to suggest that he is restricted to such a small percentage of the population.
No, no, I understand. It's a hypothetical. It was not meant to be a comment or a question on this case and the facts alleged in the complaint. But
Ms. Ashby, can I ask you a question about this case? I think there's something that I still don't quite understand. The registration, as I understand, I understand the sentencing documents. I don't see a reference to the registration in the sentencing documents themselves, but I thought that the registration was a condition of the plea agreement. So like for purposes of Judge Rosenbaum's very good question about judgment of a state court, like does this sort of count or not? If something is a condition of the plea agreement and then a conviction is formally entered on the plea agreement, and then you've got sentencing documents, which for some reason or another don't reference the registration. Or is it like part of the judgment or not? Here.
So in this case, no, it was not made part of the judgment. He was
and objected that just to because the condition of the plea agreement like wasn't memorialized properly or what? I'm so sorry if I'm misunderstanding something like really fundamental to the state criminal process, but I'm just trying to figure out. So I guess I'll ask it this way. Was it or was it not a condition of the plea agreement that he registered?
To my knowledge, it was a condition that he was subjected to the probation, the sex offender probation.
I see. Which means what exactly? I'm sorry. Sex offender probation and sex offender registration are different. How?
So sex offender probation would be for that specific term. In this case, he had 5 years subject to a certain set of conditions that do have some similarities. But when looking at the registration requirement, that has nothing to do with the statute. That has to do, or the sentence in general, that has to do so more with any petitioner's status of being a convicted sexual offender.
I see. Okay. All right. That's helpful.
But let me ask you this. I mean, as a matter of reality, I think we can all agree that anybody who gets convicted on these charges is going to have to comply with a Florida sex offender statute. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems like it can't possibly be the right answer that it's not a part of the judgment, and therefore it can't qualify for in custody simply because it's not written in the judgment. If every single defendant who is convicted, you know, effectively has this as something that he or she must do. I mean, that just seems a little oversimplistic, or, you know, and I'm not suggesting that the judge did this or that the state is doing this, but has the effect of almost like circumventing, right, the judgment requirement. If it's automatically going to be something that the defendant now has to comply with. So I guess I'd like you to address that, please.
Right, Your Honor. So it has to be a direct consequence of the judgment sentence, not a collateral consequence. A situation like this is very analogous to a felon not being able to vote or participate on a jury. And in both of those instances, the federal courts have found that is a collateral consequence and not pursuant to the judgment itself.
Except,
Go ahead.
That's okay, Judge Newsom.
What does the statute say? To Judge Rosenbaum's question, does the statute say everyone convicted of any of the following offenses in the state of Florida has to register for some version of that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so then why, in response to Judge Rosenbaum's question, is it not implicitly a term of every judgment for one of those crimes? I don't think I understand your response to her question. The statute says, why doesn't it just sort of effectively make that term, registration, a part of every judgment?
Well, Your Honor, the federal courts have held that it has to be a direct consequence, not just a mere collateral consequence of the judgment itself.
What then is the test to draw the line between direct consequence and collateral consequence? And are we just sort of blinking reality in response to Judge Rosenbaum's question? If the statute itself says every person convicted of one of these offenses shall register, especially if it says every person convicted or whatever it says, convicted and sentenced, whatever. It seems to be like reaching out and sort of knitting the two things together.
Well, Your Honor, the federal courts, and looking at this very question, have looked at the sentencing documents themselves as well as the state laws. So in this case, we have the sentencing documents that do not have this as part of his actual sentence. But we also can look at the plain and unambiguous text of the statute, and it clearly states that the designation is not a sentence nor a punishment. And then Florida courts, as well as this court, have also said that the statute, the requirement that they have to register, is not punitive. It's merely remedial.
Right, but that's a different... I think your answer is to a different question. There's a preliminary question of whether or not registration and residency requirements are part of a criminal judgment in Florida, right? And then the question is, even if they are, do they make somebody in custody for purposes of the habeas statute? And I thought Judge Newsom was asking you about the first part of that, not the second part. I don't know if I interpreted his question correctly or not, but.
Yeah, so I've become sort of obsessed with Judge Rosenbaum's question earlier about judgment of a state court.
So he's not asking you about whether or not it counts as in custody or not. That's the second question down the line. His question is, if registration and residency requirements are mandatory for every defendant like Mr. Clements, is it part of a state court judgment?
No, Your Honor, and I apologize. Maybe I'm not being clear. I was trying to address that part in merely stating that the federal courts have said that it is not part of the judgment sentence when they have looked at the judgment itself and seen that, A, it's not part of that sentence. They've looked at the statute and seen that they've said that the Florida legislature has stated that it's not a non-sentence or a punishment. And Florida courts have also said that it's not punitive. So there's no basis to conclude that it would be part of the sentence. Everything shows it the contrary when you look at the sentencing documents and the state laws themselves.
But here's the problem I'm having. Can it be that simple that we just say that we just don't actually write it into the judgment, but we effectively by law make it a part of the judgment, so it doesn't count as part of the judgment because it's not in the singular document that applies to the defendant? Can it possibly be that simple? I mean, that seems problematic.
Well, Your Honor, federal courts, it's my understanding that federal courts are supposed to defer to state rulings on state law, and the Florida legislature as well as the Florida courts have made it abundantly clear that they don't consider it a punishment or a sentence.
Okay, that's a different question though, right? That is the other half of the equation on pursuant to the judgment of the court, right? Pursuant to the judgment of a state court. That's the other half of the equation. There are sort of two components to it. One is whether it's actually in a judgment, and the other one is whether it's punitive. And here, you know, it may well be the case that under Houston v. Williams, we've already answered that question, albeit in a different context, that it is punitive, that it is not punitive rather. And so then that actually brings up my other question, which is how do all of these components fit together? Do you have to have all three? Is it enough to have one to be in custody? Could two be enough? I mean, is it a balancing test? How do the components fit together when we're trying to determine whether the in custody and the pursuant to the judgment of a state court aspects of the statute are satisfied?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't know if I understand your question. So to be clear, you have to have both of the prongs, both of the in custody and both of the pursuant to the court judgment. Are you asking if we need to, it needs to be to show that it was not part of the judgment as well as the state's interpretation of the statute?
I'm asking you two different things. The first thing is, how did the judgment and non-punitive nature of the statute relate to each other in determining whether it's pursuant to a judgment of a state court? And the second question is, I mean, is that a, let's say that you, that it's not, quote, pursuant to a judgment of a state court, is that alone enough to defeat the argument that he was in custody? It may well be. But then we have to be sure we're right about pursuant to the judgment of a state court, which means I need you to help me understand how, whether or not it's written in the judgment, but it's nevertheless by statute applies to everybody who's convicted of that crime, it is part of the judgment versus that we have held that it's not a punitive statute. Like, how do those two components fit together? Let's just assume for purposes of your argument that this is in the judgment that we, and I'm not saying we are deciding this, but just for purposes of this question, that we conclude that because the statute makes it apply to every conviction of this type automatically, that it is in the judgment. So the question that I have then is, how does the determination that it's non-punitive in the ex post facto case that I've talked about bear on the determination of whether it's pursuant to the judgment of a state court? And if you also assume, just for purposes of the question, that we conclude that he was in custody, how does that, what is the ultimate, result of considering that calculus of facts?
So in this case, Your Honor, this hypothetical, the only thing that we have, that the appellant has, or appellee is going for, is that the state legislature and the courts have said it's not punitive?
Yes, and we're bound by that determination. And thank you, that was a much clearer way to put it.
Oh, Ms. Ashby, I think the question is still on the table. I mean, at least I'm still curious about the answer. If all you have going for you is that the, you know, that there's been a declaration that it's not punitive, how does that fit into the statutory language in custody pursuant to the judgment of the state court?
I'm not sure I actually know how to answer that question.
I mean, I don't know is a permissible answer. It's okay. I mean, you know, this really isn't a quiz show. I think for you to say, I don't know, it's okay. I'm curious about, I've never quite understood, frankly, the way the punitiveness or non-punitiveness has a bearing on the language of 2254. But it may.
I to be honest, Your Honor, I don't know. I think that in this case, it is, you know, you know, we have to consider all the factors together, the totality of the circumstances, you know, and in this case, you know, the legislature has clearly said that it's not a sentence or a punishment. But again, we're looking at it in a, you know, that's just one prong. We also have to look at the judgment itself. And in this case, you know, the appellee's position is that the judgment sentence also doesn't contain the registration requirements as part of the sentence itself.
All right, Ms. Ashby, thank you very much. We've taken you beyond your time, but we thank you for answering our questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Upson, you've got 4 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. In a broader interpretation of pursuant to, these registration requirements are pursuant to the conviction for an enumerated offense. I did have an opportunity and availed myself of that opportunity to look at the judgment itself because I distinctly recall highlighting a provision that does not appear to be contained within the language of the judgment itself in this case. I don't know what it was. Perhaps it was the probation order. I know the registration requirement was included in the plea document itself, document 25-1 at page 49. That doesn't really get us there either. The triggering event is the conviction for one of the enumerated offenses, and then it's automatic. Everything that flows from registration, the requirements to register, is automatic, and no one can stop it, which is part of why it's pursuant to the judgment of conviction. It's following the conviction.
Can I ask you the same question that I asked your colleague and which she much better summarized, which is, let's assume that just for purposes of this hypothetical, that we think your client satisfies the in custody part and that there was a judgment, but that the statute is not punitive. How do we put those components together in determining whether your client was in custody? In other words, like, we know what the ingredients of the framework are, but I'm wondering how they fit together. Is it a balancing test? Is it you have to have all three? I mean, is a majority enough? I'm just trying to figure out what the answer is as to how we consider the components in a framework together.
Well, candidly, I'm not sure how to articulately answer that either, Your Honor. It's unclear to me how the court could conclude that he is in custody without initially concluding that this was punitive or punishment. But our argument, our position is that the restrictions imposed by the registration requirement consequences are punitive. Therefore, he's in custody and can avail himself of review under 2254. So that doesn't really contemplate the balancing or how many factors might be required. And candidly, I'm not really sure how to answer your question.
I appreciate that. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You think at the moment anyway, that if we find it to be punitive, that's the beginning and end of the analysis and your client's not in custody. Am I understanding you correctly?
If you find, it's our position, the restrictions under Florida's registration statute are restrictive on fundamental rights to an extent that they constitute additional punitive measures. Right. And punishment.
I understand you think they're punitive. I get that.
Therefore, he is in custody.
Okay, but what I'm asking you is, let's say that we don't agree with you on the punitive aspect of that, just for purposes of the hypothetical. I'm just trying to figure out how this, all the components work together. Is it your position then, if we don't agree with you on the punitive aspect, that your client is not in custody?
Unfortunately, it's my understanding of the state of the law that if the court finds that Florida's registration requirements are simple status, then you can't find that he's in custody.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Upson, thank you very much. Ms. Ashby, thank you very much again. We will take the case under advisement, and court is in recess for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.